Hi, everybody. This is Dan Cerucci once again for the Philadelphia Bar Association, and I'm here in Abington at Penn State Abington on this beautiful campus. It's actually a lovely, lovely day, even though technically it's still winter. And I am here with Dr. Sean Griffin, who is an associate professor here at Penn State. And Sean, you've just written a book called Gaming the Game, the story behind the NBA betting scandal and the gambler who made it happen. How are you today, Sean?
I'm great. Thanks for having me.
Yes, it's great to have you here. And of course, it was easy to arrange this because by means of disclosure, I have to say that I'm also a lecturer here at Penn State Abington and a colleague of Sean's. But Sean, you're a little higher up on the pecking order than I am.
If you say so.
I think you are. You have an interesting background. You have a background in law enforcement, and now you're teaching criminal justice.
Right.
You were a Philadelphia policeman. What made you decide to go in this direction?
Well, I wish I could take credit for having a grand vision, but in truth, I come from a policing background. My father was a Philadelphia police officer for 24 years. My brother is still a homicide detective in the city of Philadelphia. And so when I went for my undergraduate degree, criminal justice fascinated me. And when I graduated, Philly PD happened to be hiring. The plan was always that I was going to go and get my PhD. But having so many undergraduate loans, the police department became a very convenient way for paying off loans. I knew I'd always be going back to get my PhD. So the fact that I've got a policing background has been fantastic. It's helped me in so many different ways as a researcher and as a teacher. But I can't say that I planned it that way all along. It was a great 4 years on the department, and it has served me in unbelievable ways.
And you obviously did quite a bit of investigating to produce this book, Gaming the Game. It's quite a significant book about the betting scandal. So tell me how your police skills played into this.
Well, with Gaming the Game and all of my other published research, really, especially my organized crime work, the policing background is key because, for starters, I have contacts throughout law enforcement at the local, state, and especially federal levels who can walk me through where the data is, how to obtain it, and especially, and this is where the law enforcement background really comes in, how to process it. The public would have no interest usually in reading boring police memos or FBI confidential files. The truth is surveillance logs are very, very mundane and boring. If I followed you around for a day, it would include a lot of minutia, and you're looking for that needle in a haystack to really understand what was significant about that person that day. So the policing background helps me get data, but especially helps me process it, and that will never change.
I'm sure that's something lawyers can appreciate, too, because they also, many of them, use private investigators.
Exactly. Well, and the thing is, if lawyers were to ever pick up Gaming the Game, they'll realize that one of the keys to understanding the betting scandal was not only getting access to the people involved in the scandal, but I interviewed several lawyers, some of whom were involved in money laundering investigations and defending money laundering prosecutions, and others who were involved with gambling cases. And there's one particular defense attorney who was invaluable in putting together Game in the Game. He walked me through the pitfalls in the FBI's investigation when it came to prosecuting the individuals in the NBA betting scandal. So for me, I'm not a lawyer, but with any serious book I do, obviously I have to understand the legal process, and I think lawyers, in fact, one of the U.S. attorneys who was invaluable in helping me put together the book, loved those narratives because there was this constant battle going on between the U.S. attorney's office and the defense teams, and now they each got to see what the other was doing during the case.
Because you have done exhaustive research. Now, in June 2007, the FBI informed the NBA that one of its referees, Tim Donaghy, was the subject of a probe into illegal gambling. Within months, the public knew the broad outlines of the scheme involving Donaghy, betting on games he officiated with a conspirator, longtime Donaghy acquaintance and professional gambler, Jimmy Baba Batista. Is that how you say his name?
That's right.
Batista. They were joined in the scandal by mutual childhood friend, and I find this fascinating because it's a real Philly story, Tommy Martino. And by November 2008, each man had pleaded guilty to charges relating to the conspiracy and was in federal prison. So now I ask you, Sean Griffin, why wasn't the story over then and there?
Because no one ever had access to the key data, including the feds, by the way. The FBI, of course, they're looking at a scandal that has three main conspirators. Tim Donaghy, who agreed to cooperate with authorities and pleaded guilty. But the problem was, without the other two conspirators, there was no way to vet Donaghy's versions of events. So, for instance, what many people never really thought of with the NBA scandal was, okay, if you were the FBI agents or the U.S. attorney's officials, how could you possibly prove an NBA official was fixing games? You would need access to some sort of data. And the referee, I should point out, Tim Donaghy has always insisted that he did not fix games.
Yes, absolutely.
So the FBI now has him cooperating, and he's denying fixing games. Well, you're an FBI agent. How could you possibly prove he's not telling the truth? They had four FBI agents who looked into looking at game tapes, and they couldn't see anything noteworthy. Well, in fairness to the FBI agents, why would they necessarily be trained to know what to look for? They didn't even know what games were being affected.
Right.
So they had no means of determining whether his story was valid or not. One of the key things that would have been helpful to them that I got that they did not was access to the gambling records, which resolve a lot of disputes because you can actually see which games were being bet on, where they were being bet, how much money was being placed. All those sorts of things. Not to mention, they never had access to the gambler, Jimmy Batista. He ultimately pleaded guilty but never cooperated with authorities. So they never knew his version of events, let alone the supporting data for his version of events until Game in the Game was put out.
And you had access to Batista. And one of the things that you referred to him at one point in here as a slob, that he dressed like a slob, he acted like a slob.
Right, that was on purpose.
It was on purpose. And tell us why.
Sure. He had a fascinating business model. He and his group of gamblers, their betting crew was called the Animals. They were each named after animals. And he was the sheep. As you said earlier, his nickname was Babab, the black sheep.
Called him the sheep.
And he got that name from his family, ironically. It wasn't from a buddy on a street corner. He really was the black sheep of the Batista family, and they called him that, and it stuck. And so Batista and the gambling crew, they called themselves the Animals, purposely dressed like slobs. They didn't want to draw attention to themselves. So there's a funny scene in the book where they're literally meeting to cut this multi-million dollar deal at a Denny's restaurant. And as Batista recounts in the book, if anyone would have walked into that restaurant that day and saw these four slobs sitting at a Denny's, they would have had no grasp of who we were and what we were about to do.
But Sean, they were involved in scheme, a real syndicate involving millions of dollars, correct?
Oh, yeah. I actually put some of the betting in the book, actually dollar figures. I mean, Batista, just in the NBA betting scandal alone, was betting $1 to $2 million on each Donaghy referee game. That was only a part of his enterprise.
And there's one story in there about where he bet all this money. He had all this money on the line. Then he discovered Donaghy wasn't going to referee that game.
Right. And now he's in the hole. And he was trying what they call buy back, which is bet the other side of the game, but he couldn't get anywhere near the amount of money he had bet on the other side back and wound up taking a huge loss. But that's the thing. For professional gamblers, they literally bet every day, 14, 16 hours a day, and they're moving tens of millions of dollars every day.
Now, would you classify him as a degenerate gambler? Did he have a serious gambling problem?
Believe it or not.
Is he too rational?
No, all of them are too rational. By the way, many of the people I describe in the book are still active in the business.
Right.
And they couldn't possibly succeed for decades. This story goes back to the 1980s.
Right.
They couldn't have done that so successfully all these years if they were degenerates, meaning it takes a certain degree of skill, of rationale, of patience. You know, one of the things the public will discover if they ever read the book, these people start betting their games early in the morning in Asia. They might be in the suburbs of Philadelphia, but the bets are being placed in Asia, which is 12 hours ahead. And there's an entire rhythm to this. They start in Asia, then they roll into Europe, which is 6 hours ahead of us, and then it's on the East Coast. By the time Las Vegas starts betting in the morning in Vegas, millions of dollars have already been bet on the games that are being played that night.
So there's always action.
Yes, exactly. And the thing is, I think many of us, and I'll put myself in this boat, until I actually spent all the time with the gamblers, and even with the feds who were researching the gamblers,
right,
I didn't grasp how serious they were, how smart they were. Many of them were legitimate professionals. One was a medical doctor before he realized he was actually making more money gambling than his medical practice, so he gave up his medical practice to become the gambler. And you'll see that throughout the book, a handful of these people. One is a math nut. He's a mathematical genius. If he were sitting in this chair, he could recount to you, if odds change from 3.5 on a game to 4 or whatever the betting line is, he can spit out in a heartbeat how that increases his mathematical
and
odds.
And a lot of them have like photographic memories.
Yes.
Well, this is Dan Cerucci for the Philadelphia Bar Association, Hot Interviews with Cool People, and I'm talking to Dr. Sean Griffin here at Penn State University in Abington. He's just written this fascinating book, Gaming the Game. It's the story behind the NBA betting scandal and the gambler who made it happen. And Sean, I also wanted to mention this aspect of it, that you've noted that some of these best stories come out of Philadelphia because it's often ignored in the shadow of New York. And yet there's a lot of crime here.
Well, I think part of the reason there is a lot of crime here is because people aren't paying attention. It is actually a great place to be involved in this type of activity because everyone focuses on New York. And if you're moving millions of dollars and you realize the focus, both with the media and even with the feds, is in New York, well, this is a nice little out-of-the-way place that for some reason is ignored by historians, is ignored by criminologists, and it's also ignored by federal authorities, which is why, again, when people read the story, a lot of people will say to themselves, how could this have been going on for that long and no one know? And that's part of the reason.
Now, even as somebody who grew up in Philadelphia,
right?
grew up in Philadelphia,
yeah,
and were educated here and so forth.
Yes.
Are you still, like, fascinated with the characters and the culture of the city?
Oh, it's fantastic. But it's funny because I was not familiar with this particular story or any of this cast of characters before. But it's great. It's job security for me because still everyone else is ignoring Philadelphia. So I'll stay here and reap the benefits because as it is now, no one is really researching crime in this area.
And the last book you wrote just before this about the black mob in Philadelphia,
right,
that's been optioned for a movie by Leonardo DiCaprio,
right,
and his production company in affiliation with Warner Brothers. Tell us about it.
Sure. His production company is called Appian Way Productions.
Right.
And back in 2006, I think it was, they approached me about making Black Brothers Incorporated, The Violent Rise and Fall of Philadelphia's Black Mafia, a trilogy. The contract is technically for a trilogy. That would all assume the first one is successful, of course. But and because the story is so dense, it's 40 years long and dozens of characters. So doing that in 1 hour, 1.5 hour movie is a little challenging.
It's been
so
called a mammoth study of it. I mean,
I feel bad actually because that was never intended to be made into a movie. It was more to really, for somebody who does organized crime, there's so much mythology, and I wanted to resolve a lot of the mythology, which meant that that book was going to be a little more dense than a normal read.
Right.
And so it was never written as scenes that would be amenable to a movie script and all that. So when Vondi Curtis Hall, who's an actor and writer, he was the one assigned to write the script, I felt bad for him because I can't even imagine how hard a task that was. But the script is incredible. Unfortunately, it's just taken forever. We've been through 3 versions of the script, and I'm still waiting for the next step in the process, but so far so good.
And you're a consultant on the movie.
Yes, I've been familiar with all the script revisions, and I've been on the writing team. It's been
and
fun.
I was fascinated by the fact that you even have traveled to the Netherlands to study crime there. Tell us about that.
Sure. Well, if you're going to study organized crime and drug trafficking, what better place than Holland? The Netherlands has always been the major transshipment point into Western Europe. Rotterdam is the world's largest port. So a lot of commodities that are shipped into Europe are brought in through Rotterdam and Holland. And, of course, we know about their tolerant vice laws with respect to prostitution and narcotics. So starting in the early 90s, I would take students over, some Penn State students, some from all over the country, and for 7 summers, I took students for 5 weeks over to Holland with my colleague up at University Park, Alan Block, and we would have the best people, whether it was criminologists from Russia when the Soviet Union was breaking, and a lot of slave trading women originated from Eastern Bloc countries. We would bring in those scholars and those police officials and have them lecture our students about how that traffic was being done and how the red light districts in Amsterdam and throughout Holland were being impacted by the opening of borders in the 90s. It's just a fascinating place to study crime because they have such different laws and such different approaches to both drugs and to prostitution.
Are things tighter now, more controlled in a post 9/11 world?
In the U.S.?
I would say the U.S.
I would say so. I mean, look, traveling alone, as we all know, is so different. So trafficking things is markedly different. You know, but it's the
but
problem
it's not
is
to say that it still doesn't.
No, of course. Well, the problem is though our southern border is still such a huge open opportunity. It's amazing that that's never been addressed, not only for terrorism, but for drugs. So as somebody who studies drug trafficking, here we are. We spent the better part of 2 or 3 decades focusing on, for instance, opium coming in from Afghanistan or Pakistan and Iran. Well, now it's coming in from Mexico. Mm-hmm. And this is after 9/11, where you would think that, okay, that alone would have been addressed. And in fact, cocaine and heroin is more likely to come in now from Mexico if you live in the Southwest than from other parts of the world, which was unthinkable 20 years ago. And yet here we are after 9/11, where we've all patted each other on the back for supposedly getting stricter, and at least not as far as that situation goes.
Right. So now, Sean, teaching young people criminal justice, a lot of these young people are going to go into law enforcement. What's the most important thing you teach them?
Well, I always try to disabuse them of what they've seen on television or in the movies. You know, that's a new problem for people like me, and especially for people in the FBI Training Academy and police academies. Students nowadays have such a wildly unrealistic expectation of what law enforcement looks like. CSI has taught people that police are able to do X, Y, and Z, and maybe 1% of agencies have anywhere near that capability of time and resources. It's just not what police do. Similarly, you know, most of law enforcement, especially at the federal level, is bureaucracy. It's a lot of paperwork. It's a lot of boredom. Doesn't mean it's not a fascinating field, and it's a great way of, you know, a great career and a great way of life, but it isn't all, you know, cops and robbers and fun. And so when you show them the actual data of what police at the local level do or what people do at the federal level, they're always shocked because they have this grand vision that, you know, it's all about kicking down doors. And, you know, as fun as that might be, that's really not what law enforcement is.
Well, I think that lawyers in law school, they face the same challenge of trying to teach them that, you know, the law is not necessarily glamorous, and it's a lot of hard work. Now, Sean, let's end this interview by asking you about your next book, because you're going to be coming out with a new book. I understand you're working on it now.
There are actually 3 different projects, all in different stages. The one farthest along is a book on stock fraud, which involves a very infamous character from New Jersey who ran a company called First Jersey Securities. He was the progenitor of the boiler room stock frauds of the 1980s, and his name is Robert Brennan.
Oh, yes, he owned the Garden State Park for a while.
There you go, right.
I do remember him being from Cherry Hill myself.
He just got out of prison. He served a federal prison term for bankruptcy fraud. Interestingly enough, and lawyers will appreciate this, when it comes to securities fraud, very rarely is that charged criminally. It's usually treated as a civil offense. And people like Brennan are perfectly willing to pay the fine. It's like the cost of doing business. No different than a prostitute being picked up off the street, paying a fine, and getting put back out. Brennan never was charged criminally with securities fraud, despite the fact that he'd been sued by the SEC, the NASD, and investors for decades. And yet, when he finally claimed bankruptcy, he got caught for bankruptcy fraud. And that is what put him in prison, not any of the hustles that he had done for 20 years.
Fascinating.
Yeah.
That's going to be, that sounds like it's going to be a great story, because it's going to focus pretty much on one person.
Right.
Well, that's going to be interesting. We've been talking with Dr. Sean Griffin here at Penn State Abington. He is an associate professor here, and he has just written Gaming the Game, the story behind the NBA betting scandal and the gambler who made it happen, and a book Sean is available in bookstores. It's available at Amazon.
Yes.
You have your own website. What is it?
Yes. If people can go to SeanPatrickGriffin.net. Sean spelled S-E-A-N, Patrick Griffin, G-R-I-F-F-I-N.net, where in addition to the material that you see in Gaming the Game, anything I had in the way of supporting data, as I said earlier, I'm so frustrated by mythology in my business. Whatever files I can offer to the public, I've put up on the website so they can resolve a lot of the mythology for themselves.
A fascinating book for sports fans, for lawyers, for just about for anybody. And we thank Dr. Sean Griffin, who we've been talking with here. This is Dan Cerucci for the Philadelphia Bar Association with hot interviews with very cool people. Thank you for tuning into the podcast, and we'll be back with you again soon. Thanks, everybody. Bye.
The preceding was a production of the Philadelphia Bar Association. Check us out at philadelphiabar.org. Send us your feedback on this program by emailing podfeedback@philabar.org. From all of us at the Philadelphia Bar Association, thanks for downloading us and have a great day.